Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Vashaw. For the past several years, I've taught an interventions course in child and youth work. It's a first year, first semester course. One of the things that many students struggle with is the idea of a strength-based approach. The response is often, look, these people have done bad things. They're doing inappropriate behaviors. Why are we saying they have strengths? This is just sending the wrong message to them. This is quite a common response. So take, for example, the case of a young 15-year-old girl. She's sexually active. To call her good at building relationships might seem somewhere between disingenuous and dangerous. We might even question, are these real relationships? Maybe she's just being used. How can we say that her sexual activity is a search for health? What happens if she becomes pregnant? Many people would then advise her to have an abortion or put the child up for adoption. And if she decides to keep the child, very few people would say that's an example of resilience. Dr. Michael Ungar might say that's an example of resilience. Dr. Ungar is a family therapist and a professor of social work at Dalhousie University. He's written 11 books, published over 100 peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, and is the lead researcher in an international study on resilience in youth. Welcome, Dr. Ungar.
Nice to have this opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you. In your book, Strength-Based Counseling, you frame adolescents' behaviors as a search for health. How is this young woman in our introduction, this 15-year-old sexually active girl who's now pregnant, how is that her searching for health?
If we think about this not just as an individual act, but also we put her into her context. To be truthful, I have a daughter who's not much older than that. And if I thought of my own daughter doing those behaviors, I would say these are high-risk behaviors that are terribly inappropriate. Now, it's not that I have a double standard. It's that my daughter lives in a world, fortunately, that has many more opportunities for her to experience the foundation stones for developing a positive identity. She has opportunities for reinforcement, for relationships. For her, there's lots of different pathways to successful development. But many of the young people whom I talk about in my books and who I've worked with clinically or in my research don't have those same opportunities. So what they're doing essentially is looking around or maximizing whatever that is possible for them. And there's some really disturbing research on this, in a sense that when you sometimes you have people who are very, you know, young people like this who are very marginalized, who are pushed to the side, their pathways to resilience can in fact be hidden, the way I describe them, because we don't sort of see them as, well, you know, things could be worse. For instance, this young woman could have stopped reaching out to people altogether. She could have suicided. She could be so strung out on drugs that she's not even caring about relationships anymore. She could have given up any hope that people are worth attaching to. So the question is for us as her care providers and as the team of, you know, professional families, communities looking after her, how do we intervene so that we can create a whole ecology, a social ecology, a world around her so that she can make other connections to people which are perhaps less socially risky?
So given the situation of perhaps high levels of disengagement from her existing community, she's reaching out, she's finding relationships where she can. We would, as care providers, perhaps say, look, these are, you know, very, very dangerous, to use your word, high-risk behaviors. However, given the resources she has, she's using the skills that she has, and this is why we would call it a strength-based response?
That's right. If we can take a very positive orientation towards these kids, what we're sort of, you actually work with them, of course, in that you know, if you entered an interview with a girl like this and you said to yourself, I'm not going to make any assumptions that her behavior is problematic. I'm just going to simply make an assumption that this kid is looking for something. And she got out of bed this morning and said, I'm going to survive somehow. Then you know, you kind of go to her and say, well, help me understand your world. And it's very clear, some of the studies that have been done on this, that sometimes girls will use their sexual behavior, and boys do it a little bit different. This is very gender-based, of course, but they'll use those behaviors to jump the maturity gap. It's like a rite of passage. And in fact, there's some really weird research out there that actually shows that kids, young women actually, get themselves off of crack cocaine and out of certain other kinds of very problematic behaviors once they become pregnant. Like, I know it sounds really like, well, what are we saying? That, you know, the prescription is a kid who's addicted to drugs, you get them pregnant? Well, no, that's of course not what the solution is. But there's a, you gotta kind of see the complexity of what's going on here, that kids are going to be looking around their communities. They're navigating for the resources they need, and they're going to negotiate with us for us to give those resources in ways that are meaningful to them. So, I mean, I'm sure many of the people listening to this have had kids in care, or they've worked with a kid, and it's like you keep throwing a resource. You keep saying, hey, look, I'm here, you know, attached to me, whatever, and the kid pushes you away. It's as if somehow we're not meaningful yet to them. And then all of a sudden, they meet somebody else in a facility where we're working, like the superintendent, the janitor, the cook, or somebody, and suddenly there's a synergy, and the kid kind of drifts and wants to talk to them, and it's all kind of, you know, it's not like we can control it, but the point is that this notion of resilience is kids are sort of wanting to be someplace where they can feel really good about themselves, where they can shine in another person's eyes, where they can feel attachments, where they can be proud of who they are, and a whole bunch of other things. It's kind of hard sometimes, Wolfgang, to predict exactly where kids are going to find those things. And sometimes, as odd as it sounds, having a child, going through a rite of passage that involves sexual activity or testing your body with drugs or other things, can function the same way that in perhaps a better resourced family, you know, your stable, middle-class, stereotypical family, kids might be given other opportunities to experience those same things.
So we take this young girl who's sexually active, or we take this young boy who's doing crystal meth and armed robberies. How can we be as attractive to that young person as holding somebody up with a gun? How can we be as attractive to that young person, give them that attachment relationship, as well as that lover, that sexual partner?
Well, if we think about it as more than just the attachments, of course, it's a whole, so the kid with the gun, of course, is feeling very powerful, right? There's a whole identity. You're not just walking down the street. The reason why kids bring guns to school, there's a few kids who do it for self-protection, and they never show anybody the gun or the knife. Right, that's totally about safety and security, which makes them feel a little bit more resilient, able to kind of come to school. And then there's the kids who bring the gun and make sure that somebody else knows that they have it. And that's about identity. That's about sort of walking around with a little bit of that swagger. Now, I always say that it's far easier to offer a kid a substitution than to try and suppress a behavior. It's very, very difficult to suppress behaviors like stop doing drugs, stop having sex, stop doing all these nasty things, versus offering them a substitute that gives them that same, well, swagger, that same sense of safety and security. And here's the weird thing. Often kids will accept a socially more desirable behavior if it's actually sort of reinforced by others. So like the bully might actually become a pretty good person to protect a more vulnerable kid who's just new to a school. If their invitation, and some supervision, of course, is there to sort of say, you know, all you ever do is a bully. You get hassled, you get sent to the office. I know that's like one way that you make yourself real powerful and mean and nobody picks on you. But like, what if we gave you another role here, right? What if we got you something else that you could do? It doesn't work every time, but when the kid's actually looking around for something, I have seen it succeed. Interesting about the drug dealers who are kind of entrepreneurial, and you know, they actually are quite open sometimes to getting a job. Years ago, I got a car thief to work in a wrecking yard. You know, it works. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, but it actually works. But there's usually got to be a little bit of a cachet. You've got to figure out from the kid's point of view of saying, look, there's got to be a little bit of status attached to whatever the solution is. So here's, I'll give you a controversial one. We got to sort of shelve our own politics sometimes on this. That's for me the challenging part of my career has been. So I was, the girl was a little bit younger. She was actually 14. She was in some very high-risk sexual activity, often with older guys, and ignoring all the legal issues here. One of the interventions to get her to change her behavior was came up by a colleague of mine who said, well, look, why don't we, since she's already sexually active, rather than just trying to suppress her behavior, what could we offer her as a substitution? And the substitution was modeling school. Now, I don't know if I want my daughter, again, I mean, let's be honest about this, right? I mean, I'm not really keen on sexualizing 14-year-olds, even though every time I open a magazine, a Vogue or whatever, I'm waiting in the airport or whatever, I always say these kids, these front models look like they're 14. So I'm not into this. I think this is wrong. But, here you have a kid, she's already sexualized, and she's already said that using my sexuality, and she's very precocious in her sexual development, so using that was her way of getting a lot of status in her community.
She identified this. She named this more or less to the person she was working with.
That's right. And so the solution, everyone was kind of running around trying to get her so that she's not going to get pregnant or an STD or an STI. They were trying to, very, very concerned about her sexual health. And what they did was they moved her into something that wasn't just, say, go be a virgin sort of thing again, which may or may not have worked if it had a higher status, but for her being a model. And all of a sudden she had to treat her body as if it had, yes, she commodified it. Yes, it was sort of a product. Yes, it's disgusting that we're talking about it that way. But it meant that she had to sort of own it and take some responsibility for it and see it as it was her choice who she gave it to and what she did with it. And there was an empowering, I know it sounds weird, but there was a bit of an empowering process for her in that particular context, because she could still be a sexual being and say to the world, look at me in that sexual way, but I control it now, rather than having to give that control to somebody else.
And once she did that, to move into a more paternalistic perspective here, did the precocious behavior, the sexual acting out, to use that term, did that cease?
It did change. It did change. She didn't completely stop, from what I understand from the worker, but she began to make better choices about that in terms of the number of partners and the less, that she kind of had a place to go where she could strut her stuff in a different way. And she began to sort of see herself perhaps as having more value, and she didn't always have to get that from the men that she was partnering with. That there was another source of that same kind of energy. That's a good substitution.
You talk a lot about substitution in your work, and it's something that I really struggle with, because I think, okay, well, what, excuse my cynicism, but I don't buy that the 16-year-old with a gun who's making sure people see it and it's part of his swag is going to accept tutoring, the grade 6 kids to give him that sense of people looking up to him. Somehow that it doesn't feel legitimate to me.
And yet, it's funny, because here in Canada, there's a program called Pathways to Education, which has a great track record and some interesting evidence that's actually showing the Pathways, what they've done is, it was interesting, when they started this whole thing, this short story is they went to a sort of a high-rise public housing development in Toronto. And they went to there's some community developers went to the families and said, how can we help? There's crime, there's drugs, there's violence. How do we fix your community for you, help you? And they said, the parents got together and said, look, could you just get our kids to finish high school for us, please? And what they did was they came up with a rather simple intervention. Every single grade 9 student became eligible for the program. They were offered tutoring, an advocate to sort of help them, iron out some of the rough parts of their life. There was support for the parents, or better communication between the school and the parents. There was free tutoring. And best of all, there was $1,000 a year put aside in a trust fund for each kid who completed every grade. So if they finished grade 9, they got $1,000 in a trust fund. And every year up to grade 12. So when they finished grade 12, they had $4,000 in a trust fund that was then available for them to use for their first year of post-secondary education, college or university. High school completion rates in one of the, if not the highest crime, most depressing, most marginalized communities in Canada, went from well below 50% to well up, like it basically doubled into the some, I think, over 80% or whatever the statistics exactly were. And those kids actually had a lot of success even when they went on to post-secondary education. So there is something about when we offer kids opportunities in ways that make sense to them, that they will take advantage of those opportunities, especially if the whole community is on board with it, right? If there's a shift in how people are thinking about it. A small example, right? I mean, one of the most crime-ridden, dangerous places on Earth for many years has been South Africa. Mm-hmm. Huge crime rates, murder rates, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if you know about this, but a friend of mine is a criminologist in South Africa. During the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, which is like one of the largest, next to the Olympics, probably the biggest sporting event in the world, the crime rate in South Africa, especially the big cities like Johannesburg and stuff, which are very, very dangerous places to go to, dropped to below the level of most American Canadian cities. Like a completely, in terms of international standards, dropped from rates 10 to 20 times higher than here in North America to rates comparable to North America. And what happened is that people got around an idea, an image of a country. And I mean, here you're talking criminal elements here. You're talking people with completely dispossessed who, you know, to take your watch from you will shoot you. Carjackings, you know, just the mayhem on the streets, right? And all that subsided as people got a vision of something bigger for their society. Now, I'm not Pollyannish on this. And because the crime rates, by the way, went up after the World Cup, they slowly climbed over the next sort of 3 to 6 months. They slowly climbed again. But it does speak to our, you know, we can excite young people to be engaged in something and have a voice and to get some of their basic, these protective factors that that help them. And I've, you know, written a list of those. They kind of do accept our intervention. They kind of like it when someone like a child and youth care worker or a social worker or, you know, somebody kind of enters their life as a caregiver. I think they're looking for that.
So those behaviors, you know, the behaviors that we see as acting out, or that we often label as acting out, to see those behaviors, you frame it once again as a search for health. And so as I understand your work, you're saying those behaviors are ways for young people to say, hey, I'm looking for something. In my context, this is what I know. If you can provide me with a substitution that gives me the same fulfillment, then I will respond to that. Or at the very least, I will check it out.
Yes. You know, it's kind of, in a very personal level, right? Anyone who has kids themselves knows how sometimes, you know, you get a surly 9-year-old in your home or something who won't come down to dinner, or, you know, you're having, you know, grandpa's birthday or something, I don't know, whatever, you know, traditions in your family, and you know, you're having a kid who's acting out and saying, I don't want to come down, and I want to spend time with my stupid family or something like that, right? And, you know, we can all sort of chuckle about that, and usually we just insist that the kid come down and eat, and like, enough is enough sort of thing, you're part of a family, and get over yourself. But, you know, that's a suppression of the behavior, and usually it works because we have so many other supports and the kid knows they're loved and everything else. But in that same context, I mean, I know for some families, they'll say, I've seen this work as well, you know, you say to the kid, well, look, I don't want you just to come down and be at the table when grandpa's here. I want you to actually make the birthday cake. Now, that's an invitation that's hard to pass up for most kids. If you say, I want you to come down and clean the dishes and clean up the, take out the garbage and, you know, change the cat litter before grandpa gets here, then you're going to get a lot of eye rolling and frankly, no. But if you say, I want you to come down and yeah, we're going to clean up the kitchen together and then I'm going to get you to ice the cake or make the cake or whatever because I'm so busy with, you know, doing the cat litter, most kids will accept that invitation no matter how surly and bad their attitude is, because they're the ones who are going to shine when that cake is presented on the table. Now, and I've seen that even in shelters, in residential facilities where I've worked, where I worked in one facility where the highest privilege was, it was a secure custody facility for youth, so it had these cottages ringing up sort of an acre and a half lawn. And one of the highest privileges any youth could earn would be to go and work with the custodian and mow the grass in the front, in the middle. And there was a little ride-on lawnmower. And it was the, I mean, I'm not sure what the health and safety stuff is, but they had these kids, they had these kids dressed in every imaginable piece of safety gear you can possibly put on a person to get on a two horsepower, three horsepower ride on lawnmower or something. But the kids loved it because all of a sudden they were the stars of the show. They got to sort of do something very responsible. They got to shine in front of their peers. And there was this kind of moment of like, you know, look at me, you know, I'm responsible enough to be trusted to do this. I mean, there's something, and these are the same kids who are carrying guns and, you know, other things outside the facility.
Yeah. So giving them something within that context, they've then become the unique ones because, you know, in a residential or a detention facility, everyone there is a tough person and everyone's trying to out-tough, particularly in young offender facilities. Everyone's trying to out-tough the other person. But if they then become something unique and they're given this extra privilege, which then becomes a badge for them to wear, they then have a higher status than the rest of the people in the organization.
Of course, there's two challenges with that. One is it means that as a treatment team, we have to be willing to individualize some treatment plans sometimes.
And therein is the real challenge to this work. How do you find a substitution for every single young person that we work with that's going to be specific and address their individual needs?
And the truth is that not every child is so deep end needs that they need such, you know, complex plans. Just simply a chance to play basketball or learn how to rap or pick up an instrument or, be the DJ at the school play or just simply going to school and getting decent marks and having someone notice or, you know, not every kid is so deep in that they need such a highly individualized care plan. Because it really is about this notion of a differential impact.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on the kids, the more the risk factors are really, you know, burdensome on the kid, the more likely that changing their environment, the factors around them are going to count. For kids who are less burdened, just helping them with their self-esteem, you know, just giving them a little bit of a self-esteem boost is going to probably be enough. For kids who are really, really, you know, complex needs and very, very, have had very damaging life experiences, you are only going to reach them through a more complex intervention that sort of fires on multiple levels of, you know, the individual stuff is going to be looked after, but you're also going to create safety and security. You're going to create attachments. You're going to create opportunities for them to shine in front of others. It's going to take that. Just thinking about a little girl, 6 years old, who was actually in a school and she was sneaking off the schoolyard and stealing candy to impress her friends. She was trying to make friends, basically. And her mother, when it's all kind of came out after a couple of weeks that she was sneaking off and stealing candy, her mother was very, very upset, of course, and dragged her in for counseling and this type of thing and called her a little thief and all this kind of stuff. And I remember working with her, and what we did was we simply got her a different status at her school. She was desperately trying to find a higher status amongst her peer group. And mom was so busy with a younger child, and this girl just kind of been left to figure out the world on her own. And so we said, well, what can the school do to make her feel special without her having to steal candy to impress her friends? And we ended up having her go down to the junior kindergarten to work just 2 half-hours a week. Because when the door, you know, the little knock on the door came and she kind of got the rise out of her seat and say, I'm going down and I'm going to be an assistant teacher for a half hour. You know, that's a lot of status. That kind of gets a buzz about you a little bit. And thankfully, the school wasn't so silly as to offer that to every child, which is often they do, right? So, well, if it's good for one child, it must be good for everybody.
Well, we need to be equitable.
Yeah, and then all that kind of stupidity, frankly, that's not the point. I mean, other children go home and they have their piano lessons and granny and grandpa come over and dote on them. And there's all kinds of other supports and moments when they shine. This kid didn't have any of that. So this little moment was really important to her.
Right.
And, you know, I in my work, I keep seeing these same themes come up of, you know, obviously kids are looking for relationships. That's an obvious one. But they're, with those relationships come a powerful identity, which is kind of the second factor. And then usually there's some experiences of power and control or some sense that I can shape my world. And if you have those things, then usually the fourth factor is this kind of social justice, which is kind of a big word for simply being treated fairly by others.
And so that young people are looking for this sense of social justice, looking for the sense of being treated fairly.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, you can imagine a child who self-identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, or that they would, you know, that being treated fairly can often result in, you know, that's often a very big part of the barrier, that they can't have relationships, that they can't have a powerful identity, or they're being denied that because they're not being treated fairly. So there's always a social justice issue when you're sort of pushed to the side, unfortunately. And the fifth factor is, you know, things like just basic access to material resources like safety, security, food, non-stigmatizing clothing, all these things that, you know, we sometimes forget that make kids just feel comfortable in their world and safe and secure. And then the sixth factor I often see in our work is about belongings. It's like a sense of cohesion, right? You get up in the morning, you say, my life has some bigger purpose. And the seventh factor, which is often more, the more marginalized the child, the more sort of racially marginalized or ethnically marginalized the child is, the more that culture seems to appear as having this kind of differential impact, that it becomes quite significant in their being able to cope with stress in their lives.
Looking at those seven factors, relationship, identity, experiences of power and control, social justice, access to material resources, culture, and
cohesion.
And cohesion, thank you. How do we foster these things? I mean, you know, relationship, you know, they're going to ideally drift to the person. They're going to have invitations. We're going to respond to these invitations, you know, and that's, you know, in so much of our work, that's the foundation, relationship, and allowing them to express their identity. Some of these other ones, you know, this notion of power and control, this notion of social justice, how do we foster that in a real way with these young people?
Well, let's take an example. Let's be concrete here. So when I was working inside an institutional setting and the kids were always bellyaching and complaining about the rules and this and that, and one way, and you know, one thing anyone who's worked in those settings knows, that you don't want to have critical incidents, right? You don't want kids to get so frustrated that they act out. They tend to assault, they make weapons out of toilet plungers, they sharpen toothbrushes, they go on starvation diets, God knows whatever else, right? I hope I'm not the only one that's had a career like that.
No, sadly, no.
Reassure me, please, right? It wasn't me.
Yes, it was not you.
Thank you. You know, a lot of that stuff could be addressed, it felt, quite successfully by simply giving kids a more socially acceptable means to be heard. So one of the things I used to do is, before the kids escalated to that point, was I said, well, you know, if you're complaining, maybe you have a legitimate point. Why don't we write a letter to the executive director, the director general of the whole, you know, correctional system or whatever you're in, right? And they'd laugh at first. They didn't believe me and everything else. I said, no, come on, let's, here, I'm kind of geeky. Why don't we try this, right? And I'll help you write it and everything else. And they said, you never get me or whatever. No, come on, trust me. So we do it, right? And of course, you know, in the back room, I'd be kind of advocating and setting up so that the director general would definitely respond. You know, you kind of pull whatever strings you can and stuff. You say, look, you're going to get this letter. Please respond, right? And you play ever long. And they did respond.
Hmm.
And an incremental little change was made, you know, because it was done respectfully. And all of a sudden, you kind of get this little buzz. And then you get them saying, well, why don't we go for a meeting? And you bring them out of secure custody and stuff. And you dress them up in a suit or something. And you suddenly have a meeting. And, you know, there's a certain status and everything else. Now, again, these are, you know, this becomes not just token ideas. These become very practical. You have to perform. There's a real sense of this actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's something, a little something has to change as well. There's always got to be a little give.
Mm-hmm.
But in very practical terms, we can, you know, there's actionable way of making kids feel like social justice is within their reach without them having to do really nasty, violent things to feel like they're being heard.
Mm.
And it does bring them relationships. It increases their power. It gives them a sense of competency. And it coaches them, mentors them in ways that probably a lot of these kids were never mentored on, how you actually legitimately protest or have your voice heard without it becoming problematic. I think sometimes we sell ourselves short about just how much of an influence we can have on influencing these kids and how much these kids want our influence. When I wrote a novel called The Social Worker, I was, these short stories are one thing, but when you really delve into the life of one of these kids, and it was actually the social worker, the main character is based on one of the kids I met years and years and years ago. Very, very unidentifiable, of course, but very, very loosely, a little story that started me thinking about what would have happened if. And, you get the full story about these kids, you really begin to see that they are looking for someone to inspire them, which is what sort of happens in the book. But you want, I think we want to be inspired. We want a connection. And, you know, sex and violence and hanging out with a peer group that's very delinquent, let's face it, they're the easiest kids to make friends with. They're, you know, the rites of entry are relatively simple.
Sure.
Sure. Which is sad.
Yeah. But I want to go to your novel for just a few moments. I've written somewhat and explored a lot this notion of the wounded healer, and your protagonist in the novel, the social worker, Joey, is pretty much the personification, the embodiment of the wounded healer as a young person who was involved in children's aid, the child welfare system, becomes a social worker, has not fully gone through his own process, still has the wound, and the myth of Kryon, where the wounded healer comes from, is never quite able to heal his wound. And Joey makes, you know, does some, you know, things that are far outside the boundaries of, you know, burning down a house, lying, stealing, you know, for the good of his clients. Child and Youth Work School is full of young people who come in there out of what I would call, going back to your resilience resources, a sense of social justice, a sense of power and control. Young people who say, you know what, I had a horrible experience in the child welfare system or the criminal justice system or the refugee immigration system, and I'm going to change that system because it's not working, it's broken, and I'm, you know, and they enter into our field. How do we support these young people who are in that transition, who have pulled the resources enough to get to post-secondary education, and now they're here and they want to burn down the house and steal and say, I don't care what the rules are, there's a bigger purpose here. How do we work with these young people who are now students, who are now potentially our peers?
Well, I applaud them for getting this far, and I applaud them for having that strong passion to make the system better. I think that's definitely the positive side of Joey in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you really read the book, it's not all as simple as it seems, right? I mean, it's a much more complex system, and the system has its own needs and agendas. I think our job as trainers, perhaps, then becomes to help people just simply maybe take apart their own experience, and certainly to talk about it, but to also maybe to get them past that their experience is a sample of one, and that the system is much more complex. And I will caution, I do have a bias here, that I think there is a danger in assuming that our experience inside the system is the same experience as the kids we're sitting across from. Because there's that same, you know, that same sort of sense of, no, you know, I've met kids that are very happy to be in foster homes.
Mm-hmm.
As their situation was awful, and they put themselves in that. And I've met kids who thought foster homes were the most awful piece of their growing up ever. I think there's a certain humility that we have to bring into this, and to get people, you know, if I was training someone, and when I do train someone, I'm really encouraging them to have a healthy curiosity about others, even if they look like you, even if they have the same experience as you, to have that same sort of sense of healthy curiosity, to bracket your own experience and say, well, this is what I experienced. I've understood what I went through, but maybe other people experience this differently. And then, yeah, work for social change while you're working with individuals in ways that make sense to them. And that's why I've so emphasized these dual processes, that we make people resilient. We facilitate resilience when we help them navigate to the resources, but help them also negotiate for those resources to be meaningful to them. So I can't do that. If I'm walking into a situation and say all foster care is bad, then I'm not negotiating. I'm as dogmatic and ideological as the same people who probably were forcing, you know, me into foster care when I was growing up. I wasn't in foster care, but I'm, you know, thinking of somebody who put me out of that situation. You don't want to sort of fall into that same trap. What you want to do is you want to have that open curiosity to say, okay, let's have a negotiation here. What's your experience of this? Mine was bad, but what's yours, sort of thing? Well, even if you say that, but, you know, and that you want to have that engagement, you want that discussion, so that the other person can tell you. Because sometimes I've met kids who like being in jail occasionally because it gives them meals and education and safety and security that they don't find on the streets.
Yeah,
I've met anxious kids who not going to school is their solution, because school is a really dangerous place where they feel really stupid and assaulted. You know, I think sometimes we have to sort of step inside those worlds for a little bit and have that humility to bracket our own experience and say, well, hang on, maybe the world's different.
Maybe it is. I have so many more questions. However, we are sadly out of time. I know you have other commitments. I want to thank you immensely. I encourage anybody who's not familiar with Dr. Ungar's work to search it out. It's been quite influential in my own work. And I just like to close by that young woman at the beginning of the interview decided to keep her child, and while she was raising her child, was at home a lot and decided that she needed some income, and has since started her own business for new mothers. And it's such a wonderful, wonderful example, and such a story of context, that in her context she was so isolated and experienced so many difficulties and was able to survive so well. Dr. Michael Ungar, thank you very, very much for all your wisdom, all your writing over the years, your continual projects. For those of you who are interested, I encourage you to seek out resilienceresearch.org to find out his latest work. And just before we end today's session, I want to let everyone know that C2Y Podcast is now available on Stitcher. To download their free mobile app, you can go to stitcher.com or the App Store for your Android or Mac device. Thank you once again, Dr. Ungar.
All the best.
Bye-bye.